The following podcast is part of the MindBodySpirit.fm podcast network.
Welcome to Messages of Hope with Suzanne Giesemann.
Listen, they're all around you, close as a thought or a memory.
Messages of
Good evening, everybody, and welcome to a very special episode of the Messages of Hope podcast. I'm used to having only one guest. A couple times I've had two guests, but this evening I have four, and one of them is a filmmaker, and three of them are experts in induced after-death communication. I'm so excited for you to meet them. We're just going to have a great conversation and help bring to your awareness a wonderful movie, a documentary, called Living with Ghosts. Now, as a medium, I like to stay away from that word ghost, but you'll find out why it's in the title. In fact, I already interviewed the filmmaker, Stephen Berkeley. He's here with us this evening. Let me bring everybody in all at once and introduce you. Actually, let's start with a big hello. Hello, everybody. And greetings to all of you who are joining us live. I think that's pretty cool. If you have questions throughout this event, you can type them in the chat and we will see them and hopefully ask some of those questions as time allows. So we're live on YouTube, live on Facebook. Love using technology for this. Let's start with the filmmaker who produced Living with Ghosts. That's Stephen Berkeley. Welcome to the show. Why don't you introduce yourself to everybody, Stephen?
Thank you, Suzanne. Hi, I'm Steve Berkeley. I produced Living with Ghosts, and I hope everyone who got to see it this weekend has enjoyed it. It took me 7 years to make, and it was a labor of love, I would call it. And I learned a whole lot in the making of the film, because when I first started, I wasn't really sure how I felt about the topic. It really wasn't until my dad died that I started exploring. So it was really made for people like me who wasn't really sure how I felt about the existence of an afterlife. So that's how it all started. And that's how I got to meet the other panelists, because one of the subjects in my film wanted to do a particular therapy that's featured in the film. And these are the experts that I got to meet. Jan Holden, who is the is a professor and the president of International Association for Near-Death Studies and a professor emerita at the University of North Texas, was the director of the study on induced after-death communication therapy. And Graham Maxey, who was the lead therapist in the field, actually training the other therapists and administering the therapy. And Graham, I would say, is probably the lead expert in the film. And Noelle St. Germain-Sayre was in the film briefly, but she is the president of the induced after-death communication therapy. And so I thought that was an important person to have here as well as in the film.
Well, you just did a great job of introducing everyone for us, Steve. And, I'm thrilled to have everybody here, and I want to say that as a medium, it's my job to be the voice for those who no longer have a physical voice. But what you all are showing the world is you don't need a medium, and I think that's fantastic. I wish we didn't need mediums. I want people to know that you can communicate directly with your loved ones who have passed, have that real experience of that. And that's what you show so beautifully in the film. Let's just jump right into that, and one of our experts here just talk about what is induced after-death communication compared with, would you call it spontaneous after-death communications? So who wants to grab that one?
Well, I think you've actually captured it, because spontaneous ADC, which is the experience that has been most reported and has been researched very extensively over the last 100+ years. And it does happen spontaneously. Whether or not a person would like to have communication with their discarnate with their deceased loved one. The experience happens essentially unexpectedly and unintentionally. Research, I mean, there's just a lot to say about spontaneous after-death communication that can take different forms. But the important thing is that we know that it's almost always very healing for people and helping to reduce the pain of grief. It doesn't eliminate it completely, but it certainly helps. And then induced after-death communication is this very special counseling technique that is designed to facilitate people to have the experience of after-death communication during a counseling session. And that's not all that happens in the session, but that's part of the intention.
What I love and what I'm hearing here, and just to make sure everybody understands this, is spontaneous after-death communication, ADC. Who wouldn't want that? We would pray for that. But with induced ADC, you go to this session, that's your intention, and you hope to come out of there with that experience. Now, in the documentary, Living with Ghosts, you showed that you have great success with that. Graham or Noel, would you like to talk about the success level of these experiences?
It's quite remarkable, but my statistics that I've kept over the years since I started this in 2006, it's been about 92% of the clients have had an after-death communication either in the session or very closely afterwards. One of the things that Dr. Botkin put in his book, which is how most people get introduced to this technique, is that all after-death communications are spontaneous. We're not inducing anyone to have them. What we're doing is putting you in a mental state where you can notice it. Huh. You know, this is not something we're doing. The idea is that people aren't going to walk in and just talk to random spirits. You know, you have to have connection with this person and you have to have a need to hear from them.
So that sounds like what I teach in my classes. I teach people how to connect with their loved ones. Can, after a session with you, can people leave and do it themselves?
Exactly. When I was trained by Dr. Botkin, I went up there. I had to be my own subject because I couldn't talk anybody else to flying to Chicago with me, who was a client. And I had an experience with my daughter, who I never met, who was not born. But she was 23 years old when I met her. And we spent the evening after I left Dr. Botkin's office talking. And that was quite healing, quite amazing. But yes, it's not, the title has always bothered me. It's not an induced situation. We're not doing this to anybody, you know. As one of the spirits said in Botkin's book, he said, you know, what do you think about IADC? He said, oh, it's great, but remember, we're in charge of it, not you. And that's very true.
That is such a good point that I wasn't even aware of. So that's really good to make. And Noel, how did you get into this work and work your way up to, what is your title, president?
I'm the executive director of the International Induced After-Death Communication Board and Center for Grief and Traumatic Loss. And basically, Dr. Al Botkin, who Graham just mentioned, discovered this this technique and then refined it over time. And he started this protocol, which he called Induced After-Death Communication, IADC. And when Al retired, he asked me if I would take over, as executive director, basically. So we have a centralized location for information and referrals and things of that nature. So I first got involved with this when I learned about IADC through my own personal therapy. That's really how I discovered it. My therapist was trained by Al, and she was a former student of Jan's, and that's how I first heard of it. And once I experienced it, I became very intrigued, and I've always had after-death communication in my life through my family history. So it wasn't strange to me or out of the ordinary, but to see it as a therapeutic intervention, that was new. So I approached Jan and asked her, she and I actually talked together to set up the study at UNT that we did. It took us 4 years to do this study from conception to completion. And, that was, so that was a big part of it for me, was getting involved in the research, and then getting trained myself to facilitate the therapeutic modality. So,
and that leads right into the answer to a question from a listener right now that I have up on the screen. I was under the impression this therapy should be done under the care of a licensed therapist, and yet we're saying that anybody can learn to do it. So how do we?
Well, actually, no, it does need to be done by a licensed therapist. And so individuals, I'm a licensed professional counselor and 30 years experience. And we definitely restrict this practice. It is a therapeutic modality. And like any therapeutic modality in a mental health field, it needs to be somewhat regulated. And so we do require that individuals who are engaging in learning how to do this are licensed mental health professionals, that they do fall under, they do understand the basics of mental health counseling, because you can have experiences in any mental health context where someone might have a distressing experience or need some extra support. We're dealing with people who have pretty severe grief at times, many of whom have traumatic histories. And like any difficult experience in counseling, you don't always know what's going to emerge. And so you have to have someone who's trained to manage anything that might come up for a person who's
also to screen the applicants as clients, because there are some contraindications for people. We're not going to take everyone as a client, depending on their mental health history. And so we need somebody who's trained to kind of understand what that history is, and make sure that this is a safe procedure for people. Mm-hmm. I did see a question up there that said, two questions. One of them said, what about EMDR? And that's a big part of the story, actually. Eye movement.
Explain briefly what that is to people, that would help.
Yes, eye movement desensitization and reprocessing is a psychophysiological technique. Basically, it involves bilateral stimulation. It started out as eye movement, which is you follow a pointer or a finger side to side without moving your head while you're concentrating on a particular problem. And the EMDR protocol is quite strict. There's like 8 different points to it. But it's very effective, particularly for trauma. And what Dr. Botkin did was modify it to some degree and say, we're not going to start with the symptom. We're going to start with the story. We're going to start with you telling the story of the deceased person, your relationship to them. And we're going to try to find the apex of that sadness. And we're not going to deal with anger. We're not going to deal with guilt, because his most amazing discovery, I think, was that sadness was the engine that drives both of them. Wow. And you can spend the rest of your life trying to bail out the guilt and bail out the anger. And if you never get to the sadness, it's not going to work.
Wow. That's an important point.
It is a Nobel Prize worthy discovery, in my opinion. But somebody else asked about tapping. That was kind of my doing. I found I got nauseous while I was doing this with people. But I also started working with a lot of blind people. And so you can't do that. So we do tapping. We put their hands on their knees and tap the backs of their hands rhythmically, alternately, as a way of doing this. And now, since we've been doing a lot of virtual sessions since the pandemic, we have people do it themselves. We have people
wow.
their own tapping kind of under direction. So it does not have anything to do with anything but EMDR at this point, the bilateral stimulation part.
Interesting. Stephen, you got into this out of your own personal curiosity, and now you're helping to change the world and the views about the afterlife. What has this project taught you? How's it changed things for you and the world?
Well, I'd love to say that I take responsibility for the way the world is changing. I don't know if I can take responsibility for that quite yet. But the way it's changed me, like what I was saying before, I was very much on the fence. I wasn't really sure how I felt about afterlife anything. But when I started studying, doing the research and talking to people, talking to experts, and finding out that there are some real serious scientists studying these phenomena, and they're coming up with very interesting results. And once I became familiar with that, I was no longer embarrassed to share with people that I'm a believer. But I wouldn't have even known that I didn't have to be embarrassed if I knew that there were these serious scientists studying these phenomena and coming up with these very, very cool answers.
Yeah, awesome. I love that answer. Jan, Dr. Holden, you're now the president of the International Association of Near-Death Experiences, Near-Death Studies. Mm-hmm. And that's quite different from after-death communication from people who have passed. Mm. Is there a reason these are two are linked together for you? Is it an overarching interest in the greater reality?
Definitely. Well, I began my professional career over 30 years ago and started with studying near-death experiences. Well, in near-death experiences, people often have after-death communication. They meet deceased loved ones and communicate with them. And it's often a deceased loved one who tells them, it's not your time, you have to go back. But in the meantime, the connection is just so gratifying for people. They see their deceased loved one in the prime of life typically, and sometimes have really extensive communication with them during the experience, no matter how long the actual physical near-death episode was. The subjective experience can be a lot longer than the physical time. So studying NDEs led me very naturally into after-death communication. And there are a lot of similarities in terms of, these are both transpersonal experiences, NDEs and ADC. They're experiences that transcend the usual personal limits of space, time, identity, and influence. And as such, people who have them in our culture tend to be looked on askance. And so the research that findings we have about near-death experiences seem to apply almost the same to after-death communication. For example, we know that both NDEs and ADC are essentially equal opportunity experiences. Anybody and everybody, every type of person has had the experience, no matter your demographics, your belief system, or anything you can think of, everybody is a potential experiencer. We know that these experiences are not related to mental disorder. And we know that they result in psycho-spiritual development. So they're not like evil, you know, spiritually evil. So those are all important facts to know about both types of experience.
I love that you brought that up, and I can't help but see Noelle nodding her head vigorously. In reading your biography, Your research focuses on improving mental health providers' effectiveness in addressing transpersonal issues. And that's exactly what you're talking about. How are you doing with that? And explain more in detail for those who are joining us now.
Sure.
What the issue is.
Well, one of the main issues, and Stephen's film does a beautiful job of kind of depicting the way in which these experiences can often be stigmatized by mental health professionals, by religious leaders, by other family members and friends who don't understand what these experiences are. So as Jan was saying, there are many different types of transpersonal experiences, ADC and NDE being two very common ones. And with after-death communication experiences, near-death experiences, oftentimes when someone presents that to a mental health professional, to a doctor, a nurse, an individual who may or may not have awareness of these experiences, they can default to what they know, which is usually following a diagnostic lens and looking at it in terms of some type of hallucinatory experience or some type of pathological experience. So what my work is about is, and I know Jan and I have worked together doing numerous presentations. We do a lot of presentations at professional conferences for other mental health professionals. Jan has also set up through IANS symposia of various professionals from different disciplines, interdisciplinary panels. And so a lot of what I do is trying to get the word out, whether it be through professional presentations. I'm also a clinical associate professor at William & Mary. And so I teach a course on transpersonal counseling. So all the students going through our program learn about what these experiences are and how to effectively help clients with integrating these experiences. And that's something I want to mention about the IADC protocol that's really, really important. And for anyone who has these spontaneous experiences as well, after having an experience of a transpersonal nature, it's extremely helpful to work with someone to integrate that experience and make meaning out of that experience. Otherwise, we can dismiss it or think, that was a weird thing that happened, but we don't really get the full benefit of the transformative power of it unless we take the time to kind of explore the meaning of that for us and really integrate it into our lives in a meaningful way. So that's another area for me. I've got a certification from the American Center for the Integration of Spiritually Transformative Experiences. It's called ASSIST. And that certification, that training that actually Jan provided really helped me develop the ability as a mental health professional to work with people to integrate these experiences in a meaningful way.
Wonderful. And we'll be sure that in the description of this event on YouTube Live, right under the video, we'll put all of your full names and your titles and your degrees and your contact information so people can find out more. So what I was most impressed with the film, and by the way, any of you reading through the comments, Steve, I hope you're gratified. People love the movie. I hope you're seeing that. And they loved your mother. But what I was just stunned to find out when I interviewed you previously on the podcast was these were not reenactments. You followed this family around for 7 years, didn't know what the outcome would be. You were in on the therapy sessions. You see our other three guests who are with us now in the film, all live, not knowing how it would come out. That was pretty gutsy.
I was pretty nervous. And I mean, no matter how it went, I knew I was going to be happy with the reality of what was happening because it felt real. I mean, I know people asked me still, were these recreations? And I know they're not recreations. And I'm hoping that people, when people see it, they can kind of get the feel of the film that these are real people having real emotional, impactful moments. But by the way, Suzanne, because of your interview, I went ahead and put in the very beginning of the film that these are not recreations.
Oh,
so now when people see the film,
Glad you did that. So there are people asking, can we still see the film? You bet. How do they see it?
Yes, it's probably time to flash that banner up on the screen.
Is that the correct?
Well, I in the private chat, I put the exact the exact URL.
But I didn't have time to see that, Stephen. I'm working all these.
Oh, it's also in the comments section that is flashing right now on the screen. Okay. Under Lynette's name. It's there.
Well, gosh.
And you can find it there.
Well, and why don't you just tell us what it is and how people can.
Okay. I botched this whole thing. So the URL is livingwithghostsmovie.com. That's basically the website, livingwithghostsmovie.com/landing hope as messages of hope.
Okay.
Landing hope is the whole URL.
So what happens when people go there? They see the whole film or what?
That's the event page. They'll see you, Suzanne, first, because there's a little excerpt from your interview of me, basically saying, "Hi, Steve, introduce yourself to my audience." This is Steve Berkeley. So there's the first 2 minutes of your interview of me is the first thing they see. And there's an opportunity for them to click a button if they want to see the film. They click a button and they could go on and they could donate and see it.
Okay, so do I have that right now in the banner that you're seeing?
That looks right. It looked right to me before. It looks right to me now, but for some reason it didn't work before.
Okay, now let's talk about this donation button.
Right.
What is the goal with that?
So there are two different versions. Well, there's two videos. One video is a fairly short, like a 10-minute introduction to the movie. Basically, it's a short movie, but there's enough information in there so people can really get a feel for what the movie's about. It basically talks about IADC and introduces the main characters of the film. So it's not a trailer. It's longer than a trailer. It's like it's 10 minutes and you get a really good feel for what the story is. But that's available free, of course. And if you see that and you want to watch the rest of the movie for a small donation, you can go on and watch the full film. Now, I have like four different donation tiers, and you get a little bit more depending on how much you're willing to donate. So the minimum donation is $15, and that gets you a week with the movie. And if you go up to $25, it gives you two weeks with the movie, plus like five extra hours of raw interview footage with the main experts from the film. And then there's two other tiers at higher levels, but it gives a lot of options for both donations and ancillary footage that you can view.
But the goal, again, is to be able to get this onto PBS for anybody.
That's why we're raising money. This is why this is a fundraiser. We're raising money to get this film onto PBS because making a film for PBS isn't what I thought it was. It's not free. Filmmakers have to make a version just for PBS, and it requires certain requirements to be met. So that's going to be pricey, and that's why I'm basically trying to raise money for this purpose.
Very good. Excellent. So we have a question here. I'll show this on the screen. Do any of you suggest automatic writing or other techniques as a way to improve our connection and or enhance individual gifts? I have an answer for that. I want to hear what our ADC experts have to say. Who wants to take this one?
Well, I always ask people at the conclusion of our sessions, and they're very brief. They're, you know, two 90-minute sessions, and that's really all we need. But I said, part of this is, you know, your connection with that person, and you need to have a time to do that. And my suggestion is that you use journaling in what, you know, Stephen's film calls automatic writing, but it's proven over and over again, not just in our context, but in so many other contexts, that when you sit down in a disciplined way, kind of at a certain time and a certain place, even if you can, and start having conversation. It's like any other relationship, you know, you have to give time and attention to it, or it kind of floats away in your consciousness. One of the, you know, I had to miss one of Stephen's events here a couple of weeks ago because my wife and I had to take a trip to her parents' property. And that was onerous and it was difficult. But one of the great things we got was 6 hours in the car talking to each other that wasn't interrupted. And that's really what you can have with people after death, too. It does not take oxygen. It does not take corporal presence to have that kind of conversation and meaningful conversation.
Yeah, they are here. Your loved ones who have passed are as close as your breath. They're right here in consciousness. If you set up an appointment with them, say, let's get together Wednesday and have a chat, they will show up. It sounds silly, doesn't it? But that's just the way it works.
It's not silly. I mean, you do that with any of the other people that you love, you know,
we're
right here in the house with you. And if you don't have an appointment, sometimes you don't get to talk to them because they're busy, you know.
That's right. So many people might say, well, how do you know it's not your imagination? I'd love to hear from Jan.
It is your imagination. That's the point.
Okay.
You don't have any other medium in your body that lets you see things that are not physically in front of you. But that doesn't mean it's not real.
Oh, I love that.
It's like, you know, your television set. It has many channels. And some of them are pure fantasy. You kind of know that. And then some of them are on at this moment. So it, you know, having an imagination is kind of a prerequisite to having an after-death communication. There are, you know, people that I have run into that have a condition called aphantasia, mm-hmm. which they cannot, their brain does not let them picture things that are not seen. And that's a disability. That's not normal. That's something that people have to overcome.
Well, so let me rephrase that because I've heard this question multiple ways. I'd love to hear Jan and Noelle answer this as well. They say, how do I know I'm not making it up?
Right. Andy, okay, because I think we're going to say the same thing. One of the things that we know with experiences of after-death communication and with near-death experience, but in after-death communication, you know, one of the questions in the chat that I saw was, does everybody have a visual experience? And I'm getting to your point, Suzanne, but I'm kind of going a roundabout way because it's connected. So no, not everyone has the same kind of experience in an after-death communication. Some people might have just a sense of presence. I feel the person with me. Some people might have a visual experience or an auditory experience, an olfactory experience where they smell perfume or cigarette smoke or something familiar from that person. They may have a sensory-based experience, or they may have some other kind of experience. Some people have gotten like emails, phone calls, or other kinds of electronic communication from a deceased loved one. So you can have any kind of experience, but one of the most common is what we call a sleep ADC, which occurs when someone is asleep. And it's differentiated from a dream about the person in that dreams are often very fleeting. Oftentimes you wake up and they start dissipating very soon after waking, and they don't necessarily have a really strong kind of after effect. Whereas people that have a sleep ADC report that these are more real than a regular dream. They also report remembering them or retaining it for a long period of time and feeling that it is a real experience that is qualitatively different from a dream experience. So they feel oftentimes a sense of peace, closure, or some of those healing after effects that Jan was talking about earlier after having that sleep ADC, whereas just having a dream about the person, they don't necessarily feel that shift in that sense of connection and that shift in their grief experience. So it's hard to describe, but the research shows repeatedly that people describe after-death communication experiences as distinctly different than something that they just imagined a conversation with the person. So I know Graham was talking about kind of needing to kind of have imagination as part of the process, but it is a distinctly different experience than thinking about what the person would say to you. So
And also, you know, like Suzanne, you always ask for evidence from your discarnates so that the sitter knows that this is for real. And it's possible to do that with ABC too. And also just to be open to evidence that's being offered. When I trained in ADC, in IADC, excuse me, I did it with three of my students, and we came to, this is my home office, and we came here on a weekly basis afterwards and practiced on each other. And in one session that where I was the client and I was trying to connect with my discarnate cousin who died right after the Vietnam War, in the middle of the experience, his father, my uncle, who had died just a couple of years before this, we were doing the IADC, he literally elbowed his way in front of my cousin and showed me something that made no sense to me, but he made it quite clear that he wanted me to call his wife, who was still alive, and tell her that he had shown me this. And so, much longer story, much shorter, I did end up calling her. She knew exactly what it was, exactly why he had shown that. And she ended the conversation saying, "Nothing you could have told me would convince me more that he's waiting for me." So when those kinds of things happen, this is not something I could have imagined or reasoned out, or I mean, it just made no sense to me whatsoever until she heard it and made sense of it. And then in another session, when I was the counselor for one of my students, and we were sitting right behind me, and she was connecting with her discarnate sister. And at the end of, after we had finished, we do a little talking debrief kind of thing. And she made the comment that it's like a door had opened in her relationship with her sister. And within 30 seconds of her saying that, the door behind me popped open and gradually did like this, which is not how it functions. If we had more time, I'd show you. But anyway, you can just trust me that I've lived in this house for more than 25 years. It's the only time the door has ever popped open on its own.
Oh, I love it.
And so those kinds of things can happen that are very convincing to people.
There's also this small but pretty meaningful experience that IADC therapists have. I've had one where we shared the same vision.
Oh, wow.
I was talking with one client who was talking with his grandfather, and I was seeing the same scene. I described it to him, said, "You're sitting in the old Turnpike Stadium talking to your grandfather in a concourse that's right in front of a walkway." "Yes." I said, "There's another man sitting in the next section right behind you. I think he's your father." And he said, "I don't want to see him." He didn't make that up, and I didn't make that up. It pronounced itself. That just happened.
That's that shared field of consciousness that you created during that session. Beautiful.
It has been reported by many IADC therapists.
Wow. So you four, have you done multiple of these screening events for different groups, Steve?
Yes, we have.
We've done quite a few. And, you know, one thing that keeps coming up over and over again, I'm not sure, I don't think we addressed it tonight. A lot of people ask, well, what if I, after the IADC session, I want to continue having these moments with my deceased loved one? What happens then? So any of you want to answer that question?
Once you know the way, you know the way. You don't have to, you know, what IADC does is put you in the mental spot where your sadness, where the grief of that, what feels like an abandonment for most people. You know, I am just bereft. My analogy has always been, you know, if you tell somebody to go out and look at the stars and it's 12 o'clock noon, they're going to have a hard time finding Betelgeuse because there's this big blazing ball of incandescent gas up there in the sky that makes the two, it's so glaring. You know, you have to wait till the sun goes down to see the stars. That's really what this technique does. People who have dragged themselves up the steps to my office in this profound sadness, 90 minutes later, they kind of float away because that sadness has gone. And it's in that space that you can notice the subtle communication that after-death communication is. This isn't in your face. This isn't neon lights and, you know, show production. We're here, you know, the last after-death communication I had spontaneously was from my mother-in-law who passed. And I woke up one morning and what I pictured in my head, I know I was awake because I was scratching myself. And all of a sudden in my awareness, I saw a text message on a phone, which I wasn't holding in my hand. And it said, "We're here, we're together, love to hear from you." And that was, you know, about as profound as you could get, but it wasn't a big, you know, showpiece. It wasn't, you know, bells and whistles and noise and stuff. It was just a text message. And so that's really what IADC does, is set the stage for how you get to the point where you can notice what's already going on. You know, all after-death communication is spontaneous. It is not produced. It's not manufactured. And so that's what we do.
Yeah, a lot of it is about creating space and getting some of those intense feelings out of the way. And one thing I do want to mention with IADC as a therapeutic technique is what we found in the study, and I know what Al has found in his work many years before we did the study, and I know Graham's experienced this, is when you have clients who come into a session and they're grasping at, I have to communicate with my deceased loved one. I need to see them. The grasping is actually what creates or inhibits the ability to connect. So part of what we encouraged clients to do was to let go of expectation, but and pay attention to the subtle, as Graham said, it's very subtle. Pay attention to the just being open to whatever awareness is there.
This is such a good point. I just have to interrupt you, Noelle, because as a medium and a teacher of mediumship, this is what I tell my students all the time. They're trying. You can't try. You have to relax and just allow it to happen and be able to receive. And it's very challenging not to have expectations. But that word grasping, I've never used. It never came to my awareness, but it's the perfect word. And that's what everybody's trying. I have to do this. What am I doing wrong?
Right. And it's about being receptive, open and receptive to what comes rather than trying to reach and make something happen. The trying too hard and the grasping at and an experience that you want to have, that can impede the process, as you know, as a medium.
Oh, yeah. Today I did a session and I had a man's girlfriend, partner, and she told us something that he had just done, a current event. He said, "She knows what I'm doing. Have her tell me another one." And so then I tried and we didn't get it right. And it's just, if people just learn that it doesn't work that way when you're dealing with discarnate people, you know. Mm-hmm.
So how do you not try hard?
You trust that what they can get through will come through. Exactly. And you just relax and receive.
Mm-hmm. It's a process of inviting and then being centered, open and receptive and just attentive to anything that happens at any level. It could be an image, a visual image, an auditory image. It could be something tactile. It could be an emotional sense. Or it could be something symbolic that happens after you've actually been focused on it, where you then walk into the next room and find something that has materialized there that you know wasn't there before and has particular significance to you. So it's just about being open to however your discarnate loved one can communicate with you.
It's a real practice in letting go of attachment.
Yeah. Sure is. Yeah.
A lot of people are asking how they can get IADC if they want it. And maybe you could talk about that, Noelle.
Yeah. In fact, I can put into the private chat here for you, Suzanne, the link to the page for the IADC.
I'll tell you, you're going to have to send it to our wonderful Lynette later because I don't know how to access. Oh, there's private chat over there. But
no
worries. Send it to Lynette. We'll make sure it gets out there.
Absolutely will. I'll be happy to do that. But in that, on that website, there is a page called Trained Therapist Directory. And on that Trained Therapist Directory, you can search for therapists who are trained in IADC in your area. One of the things to mention is that we don't have trained therapists in every state in the United States. And one thing about mental health services is that you can only provide mental health services in the state that you're licensed to provide services. So that is one of the drawbacks in terms of this trying to find a therapist is that we may not have someone licensed in the state in which people live.
And we have viewers, listeners from around the world. I'm so grateful for that. So is this becoming more well-known internationally? That's question number one. And number two, if somebody's in a foreign country, can they have an online session with a trained therapist in the United States?
Well, the good news is we have therapists all over the world. And Graham, do you want to speak a little more about that?
Well, I know there's a bunch of them in Germany because I trained a bunch of them in Germany and so did Al. And we have a bunch of them in Italy. We have some
Italy and France.
In France. I don't think we have any in the UK at the moment, which is quite odd, in my opinion. But there's some in Australia. There's some in, there's one, at least one in South Korea that I know of, and a few others. But basically, Western Europe is pretty well covered at this point.
Mm-hmm. Very good.
And I think what's really going to happen in the future, and is happening right now, I'm seeing people from all over the state of Texas that they're not living in Arlington like I am. They don't have to come to my office. We're doing this virtually. And I'm going to be licensed. I'm already licensed not only in Texas, but in Pennsylvania. And I'm going to pick up a couple of more licenses on some other states soon. So
it's a phenomenon where when all of you watching now see this film, Living with Ghosts, you can't help but be interested and know somebody who could benefit from this. It's one of these things where you think, why doesn't everybody know about this? And Steve, in your wonderful film, is helping people to get to know it.
Mm-hmm. I
want to get it on PBS so people pay the $15 at least. You get to watch the film and you help to ensure that it gets on to public broadcasting so that more people see it. So let me.
You know, when I asked, when I met Al Botkin for the first time, the first question I asked him was, why isn't this front page news every day? Why doesn't everyone know about this? And he was the first to admit that he's not a marketer. He doesn't really know much about how to get the word out. And he wanted to make sure he didn't cheapen the therapy in his attempts to get the word out. But luckily I found him and I'm trying to do what he didn't do, is just get it out there.
Yeah, he was a one man shop for years and years and years, and he was doing the therapy. He didn't have time to do marketing. He didn't have time to do anything else. I think I was the first person that he actually said, "Hey, why don't you do something official?" So he made me, you know, clinical director for IADC. In 2006, and I'm in the same boat. You know, I'm doing therapy. I'm working. I don't have time to do the marketing and stuff.
But a therapy that's over 90% effective.
Yeah.
Right.
And almost instantaneous healing. It's remarkable. No drugs.
No drugs. No, I don't take any drugs either. So, you
know. but Suzanne, this is part of the issue that, you know, like the website, if anybody goes to the website, it's not current right now because, you know, when Al asked me to take over 2 years ago, as I explained, you know, I'm a full-time college professor with a private practice and I don't have a lot of time. It's been very hard, I think, in the field of IADC to really be able to get it the visibility it deserves and to get it out there. So I think it's really wonderful what you're doing, what Stephen's doing. And, you know, the more we can continue to communicate about this, the more we can help professionals understand that this is a legitimate therapeutic intervention. I think that's the other issue, is there's a lot of skepticism in the field of mental health about legitimacy and evidence-based treatment. And you have to do a lot of research studies to show that something is evidence-based and before it's accepted as a form of treatment, a legitimate form of treatment. EMDR went through a lot of years of people being very skeptical about it before it became what it is today in terms of an evidence-based treatment that's utilized, you know, in government, with the government. Huh. So it took a long time for that to happen. And so with something like IADC, it really requires continual research to show its efficacy as a mental health treatment in order for it to be accepted in mainstream mental health.
And I see a question about training. If any of the people in the audience are licensed mental health professionals, you can get trained actually by Graham. I think Graham is doing distance, you know, virtual.
Yeah, we're doing virtual, yeah.
Training, mm-hmm. Yeah. And it's essentially one, like 2 weekends in a row, something like
that. Yeah, well, we're actually doing basically Saturday, Sunday. The next one I'm doing is early in June, and we're doing Saturday, Sunday, like you did, Noelle, when you came to my office. You know, we just do the same procedure, only we don't meet together, you know.
So that's another thing. The training is not years long.
It is not. And for years and years, we had, you know, Alan insisted that people have at least the first course of EMDR training, which I think was just basically let him know that this was a licensed person and that they were trainable. But, you know, what we found, what Noelle and I have found and others in Europe have found, is that we can kind of do the basics of bilateral stimulation training within the context of doing IADC training too. So it's pretty compact.
And well, I see some folks in the chat who are interested, so you might get some signups, and we're meeting the goal of increasing awareness about this induced after-death communication, more awareness about the documentary Living with Ghosts, which is not about, it's not a ghost movie, it's about overcoming grief through these practices, right, Stephen?
That's exactly right, yes.
Yeah. So is there anything else we haven't talked about that we need to do before we sign off for the evening?
Well, I saw a question about asking Stephen to follow up with people from the film, like what are they doing now? I don't know if you want to focus on that for our last few minutes or not.
Hear it.
You know, I do keep in touch with Karen and her family, not every day, but I was saying to Suzanne during my interview on her show that they decided to take their privacy back after principal photography ended. So they're not willing to do another interview, like where are they now kind of interview, but they're all doing very well. Karen lives with her two adult siblings. They're all single. She's happy. She's a happy person. She's content living with her husband, who she considers lives elsewhere.
I just love that was not recreated. You could see the sadness in her face. It just dragged her face down. Yeah. At the end of this film, she is a happy person. This gives all of us hope. This is the Messages of Hope podcast, and all of you are helping to do that for
people. As she said, it's a happy thing not to be sad.
That was a great line. Graham, that was your favorite line of the film, wasn't it?
It was. It was absolutely the perfect ending to the film.
Happy not to be sad.
Stephen, I wonder too, I've seen a couple of people ask about the use of the word ghost, and I know in the title, and I know you have addressed that before.
Yes.
I'm wondering if you want to speak to that too.
Oh, I'd love to. Suzanne, is it okay with you if I address that?
I want you to, because I don't, as okay. a medium, I don't like to talk about ghosts.
Okay, so ghosts as a word with multiple connotations, you know, figurative and literal, metaphorical. And so here we have all widows in the film. Some are literally having a relationship with their husbands who is in, I guess, an energetic form. And some are just missing or feeling haunted by the memory of their late husband because they're very sad. And they see pictures of their late husband and they want to know how they're going to go on without him. So the word applies to everyone in the film. And so that's why I liked it. I also liked it because it's a mainstream word, and this is supposed to be a mainstream movie. I wanted to use a word that the protagonist herself, who's a skeptic, she would use the word ghost to describe these images in her house, if there was one. So it works on several levels. Lastly, it's a kind of a grabby title. You know, people do stop and they look and they're curious. So I think this is the best title to get the most people to see the film. And that's my number one objective, is whether or not they love the title or not, if it gets them curious and it gets them to see the film, then I've met my goal.
Well, good. I just hope that it doesn't. My goal was that it didn't turn people away because they thought it was a scary film.
Well, that's why I have you, Suzanne. You'll explain to people that it's not a scary film.
Well, I was talking with Lynette as she was helping me prepare for this evening. I said, we don't want to focus on that word ghost. We're going to talk about ABCs and we're going to get them to watch the film because it's so outstanding. I just love that you followed these people around for all those years and they let you in their homes, into their lives, and we saw them heal. It's just beautiful. It gives us all hope once again.
You know, to your point, if I had called the movie Living with Spirits, which a lot of people would prefer, I'm sure, I would lose a lot of interested people who are in the mainstream who aren't interested in anything spiritual. So I'm really trying to capture a big swath of the population with that word.
Yeah, and you might have made another mistake. I have a class of mediumship. It's making the connection. When I teach it in person, it's called Serving Spirit. And I had one person think it was a class for bartenders. So you got to be careful in the word of what you choose. Stevie, this screening period for this group that was focused on this evening, when does that end?
Well, it's supposed to close on Monday at midnight. So I guess technically that's Tuesday morning at 12 a.m. But I have a feeling that, because I've gotten a lot of emails from people asking me just to leave the window open.
Please.
So I might leave it linger a little bit. So people have a chance.
If people are going to donate.
Oh, that's a good point. But it's also because, well, it has to do with somebody, an advisor I'm working with, who tells me how to distribute a film. There's certain windows of distribution. So I'm trying to go by what he's saying, but I think we could probably leave without insulting or hurting anybody. I'm sure we could probably leave it available a little bit longer than I initially planned.
And I will tell you that you set a monetary goal to help get this on PBS for this Messages of Hope group, the special Messages of Hope screening. And before we started this live broadcast, you were halfway to the goal already.
Yes.
So now
halfway there.
We are holding the vision that we will exceed the full goal.
Oh, that'd be awesome.
I know we have such an enthusiastic group and a very targeted group, because the people who come to the Messages of Hope podcast, they want to learn how to connect with their people who have passed. And you all have given us such beautiful insights that this is possible, that it may begin with a therapist, but that this is something that we can all experience. And this is what I've known for years, and we have the experts in this field to share with us. So thank you all for coming on this evening.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
Thank you, Suzanne.
It was a pleasure. Everybody, you got the URL there. Go watch the movie. Make a donation to watch the whole thing and support letting more people around the world know that this reality where our loved ones are after they pass is very real. Okay.
Have we ever said anything about the IADC website? It's very short. Did you give that, Noelle?
You can give it, Graham. Go ahead.
It's www.inducedadc.com.
Okay.
Induced death?
Yes.
It works either way.
Okay.
Okay. Great.
Very good. Lots of great info. Thank you for all for coming out on when, if you're live with us a Sunday evening, but somewhere in the world, it's not evening, whatever the case, you're here for a reason. I hope what you heard really helps you. We send everybody lots of love and healing. And again, gratitude for our guest this evening.
Thank you, Suzanne.
All right. You're welcome. You.
Okay.
Oh, are we out?
I think we're out. Yeah.
Intuition is our spiritual GPS and the single best tool that we have for navigating our lives. I'm Victoria Shaw, and on my Intuitive Connection podcast, I will share with you the ways to connect with your intuition and awaken the gifts of your soul. In each episode, I'll draw on my own intuitive gifts and my training as an Ivy League trained counselor and psychologist to help support you in reaching your highest potential. Start listening now on Mind Body Spirit FM Podcast Network or wherever you find your podcasts.